Blog Talk Radio.
For the first show of the year. My name is Don Allen. I'm here with my co-host in Studio A, Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, we'd like to welcome everyone today, right?
Absolutely, Mr. Allen, and we're waiting for, as James Brown said, for our share.
Our share, yeah. Two eyes make a pair. We just need our share.
Our share, man. Hey, and we know it's coming, right? Okay. What we got, Don, looks like we've got a heavy menu today here on... Go ahead.
Well, we have a lot of stuff going on this morning. We just got a word this morning that Professor McAllister College, Miriam Duchess Harris, was released from her job responsibilities over there. We are actively looking into that now as we speak, trying to get in touch with Professor Harris and find out what the circumstance is, if she can talk about it right now. That's going on.
Now, she's been there, what, about 8 or 9 years, according to what your bio says?
Yeah, from the earlier intel, about 8-9 years, and
was she tenured?
Well, we're not sure as yet. We have a couple of people are speculating that she was that knows her, but I would have to talk to her personally to have that correct information.
Yeah.
But this is the same as we were discussing in the production meeting. This is the same university where our beloved Professor Mahmoud El-Kate hung out at for quite a few years.
19, if I'm not mistaken, 19 years that he was a professor. He wasn't tenured though. At McAllister. McAllister, along with the university, one of the few colleges in Minnesota in which students, African American or colored or Negro students, demonstrated many years ago and took control of the administration building and shut that institution down. You know, that is the kind of the playpen of the Wallace family. People who founded Reader's Digest and owns and controls that. They have been big contributors to McAllister for, oh, my God, at least 4 decades, if not longer. But Professor Harris, let go. That's boy, I tell you, I can tell you from experience with other situations historically, if she was tenured, boy, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, it's kind of rough going. So we have some telephone calls into her actually, and some information coming back here. And hopefully, if we get lucky, we'll hear from her before the end of the show. If not,
Our organizations are on top of it, right? The big leadership organizations, the Black Ministers, NAACP. There is no Urban League in St. Paul anymore. But anyways, all these organizations are rallying, aren't they? And certainly the Black academic community is rallying, right?
Well, Mr. Edwards, I have to tell you, these are the days where folks just are not active like they were, years ago. And so I haven't heard anything, and it's been, what Martin Luther King says, people will remember not their enemies but the silence of their friends. And,
God, you're absolutely correct.
Yes, mm-hmm. and so it's the silence of the friends thing that's happening right now because there is there's nothing out there at all. So
wow. Wow. Well, okay. A lot of things going on. By the way, update for our audience, both domestically and internationally. In the case of DeMero Booker, you remember we had one of his attorneys on our program about a month ago, and they were talking about all the things that they were going to do. You remember that?
Yes.
As we reported exclusively, no one has touched this. Reggie Chapman over at CCO and WCCO suppressed and obstructed any report on this, joined by the other mediums in this city. And DeMero Booker is still incarcerated in the federal detention facility at Elk River, Minnesota, which is north of the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
Federal magistrate refused to set bail, if you will. There is no update whatsoever. He has a federal public defender because his family put up everything they had in the state case when it was alleged that a gun had been found in the car back in November after he had been hospitalized, beaten almost to death by two Minneapolis police officers in the municipality of Robbinsdale. But just wanted people to know that this young African-American has had his constitutional rights just totally violated. And he is looking at 15 years because he did have a previous felony for a domestic situation, nothing having to do with drugs or robbery or anything like that. And so the local authorities here and the feds got together. They arrested him about 3 weeks ago. His attorneys had been saying that they were working on getting him out, but I tell you, Mr. Allen, I just don't think that's true.
Yeah, that's it's going to be pretty rough hill. I mean, it's a slippery slope because you don't have any of the well, I'm going to put it like this simply, Mr. Edwards. This is not a time of the 60s or 70s where you had black organizations and point figures of people that could go out into the street, that could make the phone calls to the judges, to the lawyers, and to the folks that needed the telephone call and say, hey, let that boy out of jail.
We're not
by any means saying this guy is an angel, but you know, by putting him in jail and keeping him there, you're sending a message to every police officer in the state of Minnesota that it's okay to beat a black man unconscious into a coma and put him in the hospital because you will not have any consequences behind that.
And Mr. Allen, you're absolutely correct. And in fact, the word is within the law enforcement community that this is a Carter branch, if you will, and that the black community can look forward to similar situations, particularly if there's any kind of prior violation, you will be violated, and that will be then used to silence you on the police misconduct piece. And so it's kind of frightening here in Minnesota. But again, Mr. Booker, who was first beaten into a coma by Minneapolis police back in late November, was in the hospital for over a week, still has serious injuries, still has those plates in his face that were inserted. His face was crushed. By the way, let me just say this for those that are out there. One of the things that I find rather disturbing is that his criminal attorneys, the Meshbesher firm, and Mr. Patton, his civil attorney, have had the video of the savage beating of Mr. Booker for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And have declined to make it public, pretending that they want to make it public, but, you know, the feds have told them, let us get this federal piece settled up, put the pressure on him, have him drop any charges against the Minneapolis Police Department, plea bargain him on the gun charge, and then the videos will just disappear. So I want to repeat that again for those that are part of our listening audience, particularly here locally in Minnesota. His attorneys have had the video of his beating, and I mean they beat him, for over 3 weeks and have declined to do anything with it.
Mm.
Okay?
Not good. And speaking of being scary in Minnesota, you know, Mr. Edwards, the Minnesota legislature previewed the top 10 issues to watch on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to real quickly go through them and then kind of make my point. The first one was the budget.
Okay.
Second was taxes. The third was health care. The fourth was bonding. The fifth, same-sex marriage.
Okay.
And the seventh, education, because they said Governor Dayton, they still owe the state schools more than $1 billion in delayed payments.
Yeah.
Public safety, elections, transportation, and sand mining. Nowhere in the top 10 preview issues to watch for the state Minnesota State Legislature does it have anything to do with dealing with the minority ethnic community opportunities, unemployment, jobs, or even training for that matter. We'll just throw that in for bells and whistles.
Okay.
I don't really see anything coming out of that. But one good thing, Mr. Edwards, next Saturday we'll have live on us with the air here, Mr. Ed McDonald from the Council on Black Minnesotans, and maybe he can explain exactly what this is about.
Oh, that's great. Having Ed on, particularly in light of the fact that the Council on Black Minnesotans are being stripped of their statutory authority. I understand they have no role this coming year, this month, in fact, with the Martin Luther King Jr. I understand that's been handed over to a special commission, handed over to them, and that commission is what led by Josie Johnson and others. So it'll be interesting to ask Mr. McDonald what duties does the Council on Black Minnesotans still really have.
Yeah, they've been stripped of everything, Mr. Edwards. I mean, just because, you know, they had the tobacco money fiasco, and so to slap their wrist, they've been hit hard because what's happening now is money with the Heritage Fund money, any cash they would normally have on hand for grant and to do things in the black communities in the state of Minnesota has all been given to a private entity within the state. Where they actually have to come up, the Council on Black Minnesotans have to come up with a plan, submit it, beg, and then see where the chips fall. So
yes.
And also, you just spoke, you know, very eloquently a minute ago about the MLK Day of Service or the MLK celebration here that was actually put into law in the state by Governor Rudy Perpich back in the day. The proclamation, you know, it reads that it's going to be a celebration in honor of Martin Luther King. Well, you know, Governor Mark Dayton has handpicked several of the arrived Negroes who also happen to be a part of the Minnesota DFL and is just doing things his way. And
yes.
You go ahead, please.
And I notice we've had no advanced announcement relevant to the itinerary for the Martin Luther King Jr. activities here in the state of Minnesota. And I mean, we're already into the fifth day of January. You'd have thought that, you know, people would have been told what they will do. I mean, I guess they'll have the normal march up the street, if you will, toward, what is it, Gingelhoff there on the campus of Concordia College in St. Paul. But I've seen nothing. There used to be, you know, that black students were encouraged to write essays about the life of Martin Luther King Jr., about his achievements, his struggles, and et cetera. There was cash prizes, and et cetera. None of that's being done anymore, is it?
No, I haven't heard a word of it. And, you know, they're supposed to be doing something, Mr. Edwards, but it just, again, you know, we suffer in our community from a few particular points of a bad lack of planning, vision, and achievement and process. And so with that said, I mean, it's just 2013 has to be different because now that we know that this has been going on for years, you know, the Council on Black Minnesotans, Mr. Edwards, has not really grown and spread their potential at all in the state of Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And so you have all this weirdness going on with them, the money being cut off that they have to apply for. That I was actually at a meeting, just real quick here, I was actually at a meeting, Mr. Edwards, where the white guy, the executive director from the Heritage Fund and the History Museum, sat at the table and basically told these Negroes, I says, well, you know, you're going to have to come up with a plan, you know, because we have the money and we're going to do things different this year and blah, blah. I said, wow.
Oh, this is the exec director of the same historical society here in the state of Minnesota that depicts nothing relevant to African-American history in Minnesota.
Yeah.
It has not since its inception 100 years ago. Oh, okay. I know his commitment in heart is with, quote-unquote, a accurate depiction of black contributions in Minnesota. The Historical Society is one of the most racist institutions here in the state of Minnesota, particularly when it comes to its own mandate and mission. Because, man, you know, if you go over there to the Historical Society, you wouldn't know there had been any black folk in Minnesota, including currently.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of history, Mr. Edwards, I almost cussed. Where the hell is our museum at?
I was getting you took it away from me, Mr. Allen, because I was getting ready to ask, is there any update? I know last week you received a text while we were on air when we began to ask about the African American Museum under the leadership of its founder, Roxanne Gibbons of the Gibbons family, and you received a text, and the text said it was supposed to open in February, but there was no date. Am I correct?
Yeah, there's no date, there's no promo, there's not. I mean, it's Black History Month coming up in February. We have two of the most significant months that the white infrastructure has given Black Minnesotans and Black America and the world to celebrate our culture, to celebrate our significant branding processes that we've come up with, like the inventor of the stoplight, peanut butter, the guy who invented air conditioning for trucks to move food, meat around, and
machines that make and lay shoes and et cetera. Go ahead on, man.
And so
open heart surgery, by the way, again, and any white historian would challenge me, Dr. Daniel L. Williams. At Providence Hospital, Chicago, Illinois, 1914, the first successful open-heart surgery. None of that is depicted here in the state of Minnesota. And by the way, on that African-American museum, Miss Givens raised $3 million.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Where did that money go? Is it in Vegas or where? Oops.
You almost made me do a church hymn. But you see, Mr. Edwards, right now you have people like Booker T. Washington rolling over in their graves because if they could see this from heaven or wherever they're at, they can't believe how the African Americans or the black people in Minnesota has walked away, especially the same suspects. You know, we always have one thing that we're going to have to look at really closely this year, especially for those of us here living in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities area, is that we have to put a stop to this sieve of money going to these same people, and there's no outcomes. You know, I was talking to you in a production meeting. I was kind of shocked. I'm not going to say any names or whatever, because I don't have the actual paperwork in front of me to post, but, you know, you can't give money to people to complete missions in Minneapolis for, you know, the lower one-third of the community, and A, they don't have a website, B, they never do anything, and C, you know, I mean, what do they do? And you can't ask them any questions. It's like me going to ask Congressman Keith Ellison, what is he doing for African-Americans in the 5th Congressional District? You know, last time I tried to ask that, he walked right by me with a tight lip and wouldn't even look my direction.
Well, and, you're lucky he didn't do you like he did Bill English years ago and knock you down and push you under a car in a fight out in front of the then City Inc. there in North Minneapolis when he knocked Bill English down. You know, by the way, you just said something, Don. I mean, I'll say it because I was very much aware of it when it happened. It sounded like you were talking about Project Resurrection when you were talking about, because last Saturday, just a couple hours before we went on the air, our ecumenical leadership had a big meeting up there at one of the so-called urban churches, and they were talking about getting some of that mental health money.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the angle now, to get the mental health money, though they got a lot of mental health money after the tornado in 2011. They got over $300,000 for mental health problems that the African American community had suffered through.
Yes,
the outgrowth of the tornado in May of 2011. But Project Resurrection, let me give you two dates here, Don, just so we don't have to worry about, you know, folk being upset with you and texting you and screaming and hollering. There were two articles in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the Johannesburg Times, my favorite paper. August 31st, 1996, and April 19th, 1998, Minneapolis Star Tribune. For those of you that say you're bloggers and everything out there, go call up those two articles and read about Project Resurrection and people that lost their jobs and conflicts of interest and $50,000 checks being given to husbands and et cetera. That's the reason you can't get anything done. See, this is the cyber age, my brother, and things are people are able to be a little bit more swifter, if you will.
Exactly.
Yeah, pulling the scab back, if you will, and taking a look at that, and, you know, what it is that runs out of scabs, pus, and stuff like that. But again, our 31st of August, 1996, Star Tribune, and April 19th, 1998. And then also read Booker Hodges, not to be confused with the gentleman we were talking about earlier, but Booker Hodges, now president of Minneapolis NAACP. Read his article in, I think it was May of 2010, in the Spokesman Recorder, where he talked about and identified the tremendous amount of money that, quote-unquote, our leaders have, you know, been the recipients of since 1992, starting with United for Peace. You remember United for Peace, don't you, Don?
Oh, yeah, yes. I remember United for Peace.
Yes, yes, sir. And that's actually where Project Resurrection was a spinoff of that whole, you know, United for Peace, until they stabbed Sharif Willis in the back. Oops, which was not a very healthy thing to do, but they stabbed Willis in the back, had him sent back to the penitentiary. But anyways, hey, man, you know, it's all part of history. Like I said, this is 2013, different role, different play. What else we got, Don? Anything we're missing? Don, we got to give the phone number. We didn't give it the phone number. Phone lines are open. These are not closed conversations. Phone lines are open, if you could.
Yes, yes. The phone number is, if you're locally here, you can dial 347-426-3904. Long distance, or toll free, I should say, is 877-537-2878. And you're listening to On Point, broadcasting live from downtown Minneapolis, Apple Studios.
By the way, where we have these large skating rinks. By the way, infrastructure falling apart. Water main bust in downtown Minneapolis the other night. Yesterday, it looked like a skating rink here in our downtown area, in our beloved downtown Minneapolis. You know what I mean? I tell you, got to be careful about this infrastructure. You know, these pipes and things are, some of them are 105, 110, 115, 120 years old.
Yes, and I'm just getting word in, Mr. Edwards, that we've been referenced on the Sue Jeffers show a little while ago, twice, because of our topic today. And we do have a phone call coming in, Mr. Edwards. Should we take that?
Let's take it. We'll, you know, maybe some question for us. Go ahead.
You're live on the air. Go ahead, please. Who are we talking to? Hello, you're live on the air. Okay, she hung up. I actually know who that was, and that was someone calling in the case of Mr. Antoine Warren and Mr. Stevens. Ma'am, if you're still listening, I apologize. I will leave you anonymous, and if you'd like to make a statement, just give us a call back.
Right.
But until then, Mr. Edwards, I am trying to track down what this reference was on the Sue Jeffers show, on I think it's KLTK, if I'm not mistaken here, but it'd be
that
very
here in the Twin Cities.
That is here in the Twin Cities, regular
okay.
radio. Yeah,
okay.
I know I had put up a thing to have a funeral later on this month for the Minnesota GOP with Hearst and everything.
Yeah,
and so they might be referring to that.
And could be. By the way, just want to quickly indicate to our callers, particularly in the Chicago, East Chicago, Gary and Hammond areas, that I'm trying to reach Mr. Joe Warren. He had made a couple calls to me while I was traveling. Have been trying to get back to Mr. Joe Warren. He is the father of one of the deceased in a brutal murder here in Minneapolis in 2010, which has never been solved, although that's not unusual in our town. So if Mr. Joe Warren is listening in, or one of his family members, feel free to give us a call if you have any questions, any updates, if you want any updates on some of the things that are happening. It's a turbulent time right now, Mr. Allen, and I want to repeat again that the latest design hustle is to get mental health money. They're working off what happened in Connecticut.
Exactly, and you know they flow with it wherever they think the money's going to be at. They're gonna move right to it and try to get the money, but you know I think Mr. Edwards, you know, before we get into our topic, I don't think this year that those type of people are gonna be very successful at this same hustle, because we sat here for the year of 2012. I know that I personally and you personally, we watched the NAACP as a whole. That's the Twin Cities. We watched the Minneapolis Urban League. We watched North Point. We watched UROC. We watched Sabathany. And we the African American Leadership Forum. And for the whole year of 2012, there was nothing but social cabals, an annual gala, a fundraiser, and nothing else done to help the lower one-third of the community.
You're absolutely correct, Mr. Allen. Mm-hmm.
And so with that said, I mean, we're going to have to – I mean, me personally, going to start have to intercepting when these things, when these RFPs come up and these people put together these bogus packages that they're going to do X, Y, Z. It's not happening no more because they're not helping out anybody except their pocketbooks.
Geez, you know, you're absolutely correct, Mr. Allen. By the way, just continue on and moving on. Just wanted to alert our friends at the Urban League of Minneapolis that we're coming up pretty fast. In fact, we maybe have passed it. You know, the legislation that came out last year indicates that the Urban League and the Indian OIC, not the colored OIC, that they're supposed to be working to create job fairs and other kind of coordinated efforts for the inclusion of African Americans in the construction of the Viking Stadium. By the way, today's the 5th. On the 8th of January, the final proposals for the bid to be the construction manager at $753 million are due. And on the 25th day of the year of our Lord, 2013, the Facilities Authority will announce the successful bidder. And I got to tell you, I'm looking at the legislation here in Studio B, Mr. Allen.
Yes.
And the Urban League was supposed to have had and begin to be working on a job fair and job development and enhancement. And have you heard anything? Did I miss it while I was traveling abroad or what?
No, they haven't done a darn blasted thing. And, you know, I did put a call into Mr. Scott Gray, and it's always intercepted by his executive assistant. And I said, hey, can you have Mr. Gray to give me a call? And I want to just ask him some questions about what exactly are their plans, because I'm putting together a story talking about greasing the squeaky wheel of outreach. And as you said a few minutes ago, you know, we're in a cyber age, and these folks think, you know, running here, running there is going to help them out. And it's already been proven once or twice this year already, and last year that, you know, you keep doing this stuff the same old way, it's not going to help you out as far as letting people know what's going on.
Well, absolutely. And, again, I just want to repeat over the air. Give that phone number out again in case anybody wants to question us or et cetera. But I'm looking again at House File 2958, which is the legislation that created our beautiful, quote-unquote, soon-to-be-constructed People's Stadium. And I keep looking at that some of our legislators specifically attempted to get the African-American and other communities of color at least engaged in some form or shape and form. And the Minneapolis Urban League is supposed to be involved in under workforce, is supposed to be involved in already holding our workshops and et cetera, and putting in place the mechanism for job fair training and et cetera. And I'm just wondering when that's going to happen, because here's the reason I'm saying that, Mr. Allen. I am very much aware that there is no structured legal language in the proposal or in the request for proposal that will lock a construction manager into, quote-unquote, dealing with communities of color and the question of diversity. And I was just wondering where the two Metropolitan Council representatives, employees who are double-dipping, drawing a state salary on one hand and being paid private monies by the Vikings to put together a diversity plan, which was supposed to be the responsibility of Velma Carvel, the director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. And none of this is happening. And I'm just sending word back out to our buddies who refer to us as Jekyll and Hyde and Ronnie and Donnie and et cetera, that, you know, you boys and girls better get on top of it, man, because I don't think you got any time left, Mr. Allen, I got to tell you.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you 100% on that.
And by the way, let me do this so that it is memorialized, if you will. The Pacific proportion of the legislation that we're talking about, Section 17, Statute 473J.121, employment. That's for all you hustlers out there who always pretend when you get together at the Spruce or other kinds of places, and particularly J.D. Hoyt's and Monte Carlo's, eating them good steaks and things, that Ronnie and Donnie don't know what they're talking about. That's the legislation. That's the section where you can find it. And it clearly indicates what the mission of the Urban League of Minneapolis, Indian OIC, and a quote-unquote later-to-be-identified job development organization, which will probably be Urban Venture, are supposed to be doing. And, Don, it's not happening. Our people are not going to get any employment on the Viking Stadium. I cannot overemphasize that, my friend. But anyways, what do we have? What do you have any calls coming back in?
We have no calls coming back in, but we'd like to thank our guests in the chat room. Again, that number is, you can dial toll-free, 877-537-2878. And, Mr. Edwards, we had a lot of interesting things going on over the Christmas break and the holiday, especially, you know, the topic for today's show, the ghost of Benghazi, has operatives try to topple the 2012 re-election of President Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And we have, I know we're going to go ahead and discuss probably several theories here that are going on and what's happening with it. And I ran across some interesting news that I'll share later after you open it up. But we'll just let you know, we deal with the issues. We're not speaking for the people. We're just speaking on the issues. And
on the issues. Yes. Well, first of all, it's clear that the extreme conservative right owes Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton an apology for suggesting that she was, this is a word that used to come out of South Africa when they used to do blacks in back there in the days of apartheid, that she was shamming when she said that she was not well, and then, you know, she had the fall in her home, and now it was discovered, and probably it was a blessing because that led them to discover a very dangerous blood clot. But anyways, Mr. Allen, my associate here, had uncovered some information out of England, out of London, by, as I think it's two periodicals there, Mr. Allen, that were saying that Secretary Clinton had been on a secret mission to meet with high-ranking Iranian diplomats, and she had been involved in a plane crash and had been injured. And I said to my colleague that, well, that's great. So where did it happen? When did it happen? What country did the crash take place? And I said to my associate, Mr. Allen, that I find that to be a part of a right-wing-driven conspiracy, because what really is going on in Benghazi, I got to tell you, Mr. Allen, I just think that David Petraeus and the CIA had a lot more to do with the raid on the consulate in Benghazi that led to the death of the American ambassador to Libya and three contractors, military contractors, who were all former Navy SEALs who were all killed in what was like a nine-hour gun battle. And I was pointing out to my associate, Mr. Allen, that one of the things that was real peculiar is that we never saw, nor did we ever hear, or did we ever see anybody state the identification of any, quote-unquote, wounded or killed of the insurgents. Now, this was a nine-hour firefight, according to what they said, including being able to track the Ambassador Stevens, from the consulate to a safe house. Now, both Mr. Allen and I are well aware of the safe house concepts, these little hidden places and et cetera.
Yes.
They were able to corner him and to kill him. Okay, well, they said he died from asphyxiation. But I said to Mr. Allen that, and they were coming with these theories, my theory is that the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, and you heard it here, was actually a CIA operation. David Petraeus was more than involved in it, and that it all had to do with using Benghazi as a issue to undermine, slander, and ultimately defeat Barack Obama. It didn't catch hold because what people don't seem to realize is that Americans are not real big on what happens overseas, okay? And I repeat what I said again. I just feel that there is intel out there, and it is, some of it is contained in the classified reports that were given to the Congress back in late November, Mr. Allen, that this may have very well been an American venture handled by rogues. Notice I use the word rogues inside of the CIA to assist the right wing in creating a situation which would have embarrassed President Barack Obama and led to his defeat. And I call your attention to the last two debates, the presidential debates, and the total inability of Mitt Romney to be able to confront and quote-unquote corner the president with that, okay? And I think you saw the anger and frustration with John McCain when he attacked what was going to be the nomination of Susan Rice to be Secretary of State. So that's some of the theory that's coming from at least one part of On Point here in the United States, that the Benghazi situation was too well coordinated to be handled by a bunch of sandheads, if you know what I'm saying, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, yeah.
That this was a well-coordinated military action, if you will. They were talking in terms of grid bombing, what is called, you and I know, grid bombing and et cetera, where you've already laid out your grids. You're bringing in and firing mortars and propelled grenades and et cetera. There's something greatly wrong, and I think what we're faced with right now is a significant attempt to cover up. And they decided to go after Hillary Clinton. And lo and behold, the good Lord had his hand on her shoulder to the extent that her physical situation was legit. Okay? So that's my take, Mr. Allen, on what was being developed over there in England by Rupert Murdoch. Oops! And his people.
Oh, you're going to put it on Rupert like that? Okay.
That's right, baby. Dropping it on Rupert.
Okay, okay. Well, you know, Mr. you just mentioned the article, and I just came across it, and I'm not going to give it any more credence than you just gave it, but I'm just going to... You know, but there's some issues here that we're going to have to look at as soon as I get the studio monitor up here. Here we go. The European Union Times, okay, came out with a story. It says Clinton injured, U.S. Navy SEAL killed in a secret mission to Iran. And the crash, transport aircraft, they say, crash landed nearly 3 weeks ago near the Iranian city of Ahvaz, that's Ahvaz, near the Iraq border. And it says Iranian, I'm not going to read it word for word, but it just says Iranian intelligence agents quoted the GRU, which is the Foreign Military Intelligence, report confirmed that the C-12 Hurricane aircraft is still in their possession. And they still have the aircraft, and it was forced to land because of technical problems.
And is that right? Is that the cover story?
Yeah, that's the cover story they're putting there. And they said they still have, it was forced to land, they have it. The U.S. Navy SEAL member reported killed in this bizarre incident. This report says was identified as Commander Job W. Price. So, I mean, it's pretty unusual, but...
Let me say something on that, Mr. Allen. It's interesting that the corresponding time that is now being identified by these publications is the same time that two things were happening, one over the Gulf, the other one inside of Iran, when Iran attacked two American drones.
Yes.
And in one situation, a American drone much smaller than the RD-70 that the Iranians pirated from the United States and now have, and they and the Chinese and the Russians are dissecting. I find it interesting that corresponding time. What was the identification of the aircraft? Did you say it was a C-5 or
it was a C-12 Huron military passenger transport aircraft? Is what they're saying. Yeah.
Uh huh. And they're saying that it crash landed inside of Iran
near the border of Iraq border by the Iranian city of Ahvaz. AZ. And I'm just looking, I'm scanning through it here, skimming through it here, looking here.
I'm looking also at my map of Iran and the city of Aziz or Azip. That's interesting. So the secretary was aboard this aircraft. She was injured.
Yes.
The Navy SEAL was killed. Should we assume that he was killed defending the Secretary of State? Which then also means that American Special Operations Forces had to go inside of Iran and rescue the secretary, right? Would you not agree?
Yes, yes.
I mean, not the secretary being injured was not going to walk out of Iran into Iraq with all that hostility. Okay. So, is there any more to this, Mr. Allen, that we can kind of take a look at here?
No,
because this is not something that Donnie and Ronnie made up. These are narratives coming out of two British publications controlled by Rupert Murdoch. Go ahead.
And then I'm going to look for this other piece here real quick here. Monitor's running extra slow today, but that's okay because I'm going to scroll right down and find it. And then there was another news agency, Mr. Edwards, that seemed to confirm and collaborate this piece. Just let me see if I can find it here, because it's all over the board here.
Okay.
And I, like I said, our servers are running very slow. And let me just find this here. And here we go. Boom. And then we'll go like this. And I'll get the confirmation. Okay, and here goes a piece that was done. It looks like it was done. It's by the same newspaper. The first piece was, let me just get the dates correct here. First piece was posted December 30th. This piece was posted on January 2nd. Obama warned to prepare for Hillary Clinton's death. And it talks again about the military, the Foreign Military Intelligence Agency, GRU, reporting that circulating that in the Kremlin that the state, the President Obama was informed by the White House medical personnel shortly after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton returned to the United States and her health prognosis was grim, her of their surviving the crash, and it was diminishing by hours. So, yeah. So they actually confirmed their own report, basically, is what they're saying. And so that was the second report. Now, I have not found anything mainstream media-wise that will deny or confirm this
right.
report.
Don, let us do this for purposes of geography and et cetera. Give me, once again, the spelling of the city.
The city, let me go back to that. Okay.
Is it A-H-V-A-Z?
It's just A-H-V-A-Z.
All right. This is a city, as Mr. Allen has pointed out, that is in the southwest corner, probably about 300 miles north of the Persian Gulf, probably about 115 miles from the Iraqi border, and it's probably about 700 miles from Tehran, the capital. It is in the southwestern corner of Iran, okay?
Yes.
Okay, now they're saying that that's where the aircraft went down?
That's where the aircraft went down. It was the plane, the Heron, and it's still in the possession of the Iranian government and was forced to land because of a technical problem. So
this aircraft was forced to land. And in situations like that, by the way, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard would immediately take control because they are the paramount military arm of the Iranian armed forces. Now let's just do a hypothetical here, and I see we don't have any calls. No one really wants to deal with this. Now the plane lands; it has mechanical trouble, or it was not authorized to enter Iranian airspace, which would seem to be unusual if she was going to a secret meeting. I mean, this would have better played out if we'd have been talking about something going on in Syria, but Syria is too far away. So the plane is forced down. Some way or another, the Secretary of State of the United States of America is injured. Who was it that brought her out of Iran?
I have no idea. They're not saying that, but now the Switch Broadcasting Corporation, the SBC, has posted a story, U.S. plane stuck in Iran for repairs after emergency landing. They're saying a small U.S. commercial plane has been stuck in Iran for nearly 3 weeks after making an emergency landing near the city of Evez and the country's airports director said on Sunday. The plane was forced because of technical problems. They are not saying who was in the plane or anything like this, but this is the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation who has just put this second report out on this. And, this might snowball, Mr. Edwards.
Well, certainly. Now, what was the date again, Mr. Allen, that this plane came? I mean, what is the specific date that the British news sources are saying? What was the so-called time frame?
December? December 30th is what it looks like here. Please wear a news December 30th report. Let me just go back and just make absolutely sure. The report was posted December 30th. Have 190 comments. And, again, the servers are moving a little slow. So let me just get that up and get that activated here so we can get that date.
Okay. And we were outside of the country. We can well remember when the announcements were made about the fact that there seemed to be some health problems, but that came at a time when the conservatives maintained that the Secretary of State, and this was after they had whipped up pretty good on Susan Rice, but the president had accepted the withdrawal of her name. Now, the 30th of December, that's going to be that's going to be interesting that they put the Secretary of State in Iran, in the southwest corner of Iran. The plane crashes or is damaged, but to the extent that she's injured. So that meant that the Iranians had to can you believe the Iranians letting that kind of propaganda go, quote unquote, up unpublished?
No, I can't.
They had to facilitate for the evacuation of America's Secretary of State to return her to the United States, have her put in the hospital. See, it's only the 5th of January. She was let out 3 days ago. We saw pictures of her leaving the hospital there in New York. But 3 or 4 days before that, they were talking about that she had fallen in her home. Now, that those broadcasts were coming out just a tad before the crash. This is fascinating. This is fascinating.
Yes. And Mr.
Because
Edwards,
my sources are saying this is all a part of a cover-up, as they really don't want her to testify on Benghazi because they do not want to reveal the role of David Petraeus. And one of the reasons is that David Petraeus had not let it be known that he had gone to Libya and that also the United States was involved in rendition. That's a nice word for torture. Libyan nationals attempting to get them to indicate that they were the masterminds behind the attack in Benghazi, okay?
And Mr. Edwards, we have a call.
Let's get it. Let's get it.
Okay. You're live on the air. Who's calling?
The parents of Anton Warren?
Yes, go right ahead, sir. How you doing?
I was told that you were trying to get in contact with me about something.
Yeah, you had called me. This is Joseph, right?
Yes.
Yes, you had called me about a week and a half ago, and I was trying to get back. I was traveling and out of the state.
Okay.
And I have a message from you, which I will not repeat over the air. It's private and personal, from a father trying to get some additional ideas and help. But yes, and any questions that you have, go right ahead.
Well, I was basically just trying to figure out, since I'm at a standstill with the Minneapolis Police Department, on basically what avenue should I take next?
Well, here's my reflections, and I'll be giving you a call at the number that you left for me a couple weeks ago. My sense is that about 3 weeks ago, you and two other members of the respective families called and talked in terms that there was a Department of Justice or FBI representative or spokesman that was supposed to get back to you, a woman. You gave us her name over the air. Did the feds ever get back to you?
No, nobody ever called
me. Right. Now, here's the problem. The current U.S. attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota, an African-American by the name of Mr. Jones, Todd Jones, is also the acting head of the ATF, if I'm not mistaken. So he's not in Minnesota a lot. But here's what I would suggest. I would suggest a communique with probably maybe a couple of your ministers or et cetera signing off to Attorney General Eric Holder, asking that a case file be opened in the matter of the death of your son and an associate in a very violent and brutal manner, that you petition. It's what's called petition, that you petition the Attorney General of the United States to direct that a case file be opened and an investigation be initiated to find out what really happened and what progress, if any. My understanding, Joe, is that there's no progress being handled. Case is not even being worked on. Okay. But that's what I would suggest to you. I have some additional reflections of a more a personal nature, if you will, with some of the players involved. But though that will be a private conversation between you and I. But for the purpose of over the air and people that are concerned and have been following this, you're going to have to petition the Attorney General of the United States. You're going to have to ask him to direct the U.S. Attorney for the Federal District of Minnesota to order the FBI. Yeah, that's who the FBI works for. Okay, people tend to forget that. The FBI works for the American people, but specifically they work for the Department of Justice, to open a case file and to begin interviews and talk to you, talk to the mothers of both of the deceased, if you will, go to the penitentiary there in Indiana and talk to an individual there, talk to a couple other individuals, find a couple of other individuals who apparently had in-depth knowledge about the murder, the vicious murder committed against your son and his friend. That's what I would suggest. I think that you've been more than patient. It's going on 3 years now.
Yes.
There's really no progress. It's now a cold case that is not being looked at. I think that the Minneapolis Police Department has been pretty disrespectful to you and your family and loved ones,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And so on the air publicly, that's what I would suggest. And what I would do is that without you talking about your specific location, do you live in Illinois or Indiana?
Indiana.
I would then reach out to my congressperson there. I'm pretty sure I know which of the three cities that you live in there. I would seek out my congressperson, and I would solicit the support of my congressperson to kind of part the waters, carry the communique to the Attorney General, your United States representative there in northern Indiana. You know what I'm saying to you?
Yes.
Okay. To me, that's the situation and the predicament that you're in right now. Because I can tell you that there's nothing happening up here. They have no interest whatsoever of solving the case or dealing with some of their informants and drug dealers, if you will, that they know were involved in some aspects of the execution and the murders. Okay?
Okay.
So that would be my recommendation.
Okay.
All right. And I'll be back to you later on within the next hour after we leave the air.
Okay.
All right. Thank you,
sir. I look
sir.
Forward to hearing from you. Thank you
All
very
right.
much.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Another situation. We certainly appreciate the call from that was the father of one of the deceased. And it's just sad. Nothing's happening. At the top of this program, by the way, Mr. Allen this program broke the news that the DeMar Booker, a young African-American, beaten almost to death by Minneapolis police officers in late November, is still being held incommunicado, if you will. No bail has been set on a gun charge, and his state criminal case and his state civil case have been put on hold as the authorities pressure Mr. Booker and his family to agree to a plea bargain and to drop any civil action he may have against the Minneapolis Police Department for almost killing him.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how things work up here, man.
Yeah, it's all good in the neighborhood up here. And it's funny that it's not funny, but we should mention the police department because this new police chief, Mr. Edwards, I just was thumbing through some pages here in the other studio.
Uh-huh.
She's holding up, Mayor R.T. Rybick. Whenever someone gets shot or killed in North Minneapolis or anywhere in his city, he says, you know, he goes on this campaign with all these stats talking about crime is down.
Yes.
And here you have this new police chief with a poster. She's holding it up. It's on the Star Tribune website. Violent crime is up slightly in 2012. Okay?
Yes. And yet, as late October, the mayor, that's before he made a decision he wasn't going to run again. The mayor and the new incoming chief, Janae Hato, first female chief here in the history of the Minneapolis Department, were saying that violent crime was down.
Yeah.
Okay? All of a sudden, they started playing with the figures that it was up a tad, and I think it had to do with all these rash of homicides we had in November and December here in Minneapolis. And, I mean, we had a lot. You know what I'm saying? I mean, nothing compared to Chicago and 500 human beings losing their lives. But for a city of this size, we had a lot in November and December.
Yeah, especially like from November 25th to December 31st, 2012. I'm looking at the 4th precinct, which is North Minneapolis, the violent crimes. You have homicide. Rapes are starting to really pop up again. A business robbed, a person robbed, aggravated assault, and domestic violence. The most on the map that it's showing here is the rapes and the robbery by person. So they stretch from Theodore Worth Park all the way up to 44th and Humboldt there off 94.
And all of that is the 4th Precinct. By the way, for those that were big fans of his, like Johnny Northside and some of that crew, you know, Mike Martin was relieved of command, though he is now commander of the street gang unit called SAFE. So he's still passing information back to Johnny. You know, hey, Mike, I know what you're doing. We all hip to it. But anyways, Mike Martin was relieved, and they brought in kind of a low-keyed inspector who, you know, just kind of wants to go through the motions. His name is now Inspector Jules. In fact, his wife is a homicide investigator, so, you know, kind of got everything in the family. Oops. And if I'm not mistaken, maybe one of those that was supposedly going to be investigating the Warren murder. Oops.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But anyways, we've had some significant changes. By the way, I know Janae is basically putting in place her team, if you will. She's appointed all her chiefs and inspectors, if you will, and now is finishing up with her commanders. Okay. Mm-hmm. One thing that did come out of this, I was rather surprised, is that a very, very respected African-American lieutenant by the name of Arredondo is now the head of Internal Affairs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we really haven't had, and this is interesting history, very quickly. Maybe we would have had this if we'd had a Black History Museum. Oops.
Yeah.
The last time we really had the first Black to ever head, and this goes to show you the progress, was almost 30 years ago, was the legendary and beloved Raymond Presley was the first African-American to head up the Internal Affairs Unit. We really don't give command of the Internal Affairs Unit to a lot of African-Americans, if you know what I mean.
No. Yeah.
But anyways, Lieutenant Arredondo is now the commander of Internal Affairs. That may be some kind of message. Only time will tell. But Mike Martin, our good friend Mike Martin, out at the 4th Precinct.
Wow. And, you know, I had posted that when we broke the news here on a show about a month ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I posted to North Talk, and, you know, they erased it. They took it down.
No.
Yes, they did. They all, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, that kind of thing going on. I'm like, wow, it's like that.
Oh.
And Mr. Edwards, it is 3:57 I have here on the show clock, which means that we have about 3 minutes to go.
Anything? Oh, well, we got to do this, Don. We got to play the sports game.
Okay.
Minnesota Vikings, Green Bay Packers at Lambeau Field in the great frozen tundra, if you will. I'm really pulling. I think that Adrian Peterson is one of the great success stories of any sport, professional or amateur, but I just don't think he can continue to carry this team on its back. It may have helped if the Vikings were running the old single wing, where the only thing the quarterback did was block, because the quarterback, we got it to controls. I'm afraid he's just not going to be able to get the job done, Don.
Yeah.
And you've got a very talented quarterback, but unfortunately he's Black, named Joe Webb, and I just don't think Joe's going to ever get in the game. I you know, in my column in the Spokesman Recorder a couple weeks ago, I just encouraged the Vikings to go ahead and release Joe Webb or trade him. Tremendous talent. He could help a team like Kansas City, as an example. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Or Arizona, where we have the very outstanding our Fitzgerald Jr. But anyways, Vikings, I'm not going to make the call. I'm going to stay with the Vikes. I'm thinking that the Vikes can pull it off if Musgrove, the offensive coordinator for the Vikings, uses some imagination, which he doesn't really have a lot of. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of imaginations to just hand the ball off to the greatest running back in modern history of the NFL.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I could do that, you know, and I'm 73 years old. I mean, you know what I mean? Just
get
the ball and just hand it off and then dance back and look pretty and wave to my new my new wife.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That don't take a lot. But I got to tell you, my friends, Adrian Peterson, one of the great stories of not only, but one of the greatest athletes in modern times, man.
Yeah, and before we go, Mr. Edwards, I just got something in the chat room. One of our conservative friends are asking, why does Michelle Obama need 24 assistants? The money could be spent on the people's income and be better spent in public schools or policing the street? What do you think? How does Michelle, care about the community or her black community or her?
Well, let me say, that's interesting because all first ladies have assistance, and some have had greater numbers. But the last time I looked, a person who's working in the White House, if I'm not mistaken, they're paying taxes and feeding a family, aren't they?
Yes.
They're aren't they citizens who are being employed?
Yeah, that's I think so, exactly.
Ah, so I'm not understanding what the person was saying. If they were saying that Michelle Obama, the first lady, and by the way, it's really difficult for a lot of white folks to refer to her as the first lady, if she was going to Paris and on spending frenzies and buying $300,000 or $400,000 worth of dresses and et cetera for her and her daughters, then I would think there would be some legitimacy. But if the person is saying to you from the chat room, 24 human beings, Americans, you understand, are being employed, man, I would think that was a good thing.
I would too. And then with that said, we're almost out of time. We thank everyone for listening to On Point. Mr. Edwards, any last words before we close?
Nothing, Mr. Allen.
Okay,
God bless
we'll
America.
We'll be back next week.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.